A Brush With is sponsored by Bloomberg Connects, the arts and culture app. Created by Bloomberg Philanthropies, Bloomberg Connects lets you access museums, galleries and cultural spaces around the world on demand. Download the app to access digital guides and explore a variety of content. Hello, I'm Ben Luke and welcome to A Brush With, the podcast from the art newspaper in which I talk to artists about their influences, from writers to musicians, filmmakers and of course other artists, and the cultural experiences that have shaped their lives and work. And in this episode, it's A Brush With Alex Katz, one of the most distinctive and influential painters of recent decades. Since he began painting in the 1940s, Alex has aimed to paint what he's called the now, to distill fleeting visual experiences into timeless art, whether that's a spark of interaction between friends or family, the play of light across water, a field of grass or between the leaves of a tree, the movements of dancers, the electric illumination of an office building at night, or, more than anything else, stolen glances, everyday gestures and intimate exchanges with his wife Ada, who he's painted more than 1,000 times since they married in 1958. From the start, Alex has aimed to match what he calls the muscularity of the abstract expressionist artists that were dominant in New York when he emerged onto the art scene there in the 1950s, while never giving up on observed reality. He has said, "The optical element is the most important thing to me." Born in Brooklyn in 1927, Alex Katz continues to live in New York and works between there and a studio in Lincolnville in Maine, where he spends his summers. He studied at the Cooper Union School of Art in New York and the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture in Maine. Both schools were important in the development of principles that continue to be important to him today. Cooper Union in terms of the drawing that underpins everything he does, and Skowhegan in prompting him to paint outside, leading eventually to what he calls the automatic painting that's the first step in his process, an immediate and direct response to a figure, object, cityscape or landscape that builds steadily towards the final piece. As we'll hear, the first works with which Alex says he knew he was making art were his collages, made in the mid to late 1950s. While they were atypical in terms of his painterly language, they helped establish compositional simplicity and a glimpsed response to the everyday that has defined his art ever since, with images of Ada paddling or a cove at sunset captured in simple shapes cut from hand-coloured paper. He made a breakthrough in his painting shortly after that too, setting his figures starkly against backgrounds in a single unified colour, as in the paintings Ada in a White Dress of 1958, in which she's pictured amid a verdant green, and Paul Taylor from 1959, in which the renowned choreographer is set in a field of deep grey. Having established a unique style, Alex quickly evolved his approach to his subject matter, making double portraits of the same figure, as in Ada of 1959, and also venturing into cutout figures, first in canvas on wood, then painted directly onto wood, and eventually onto aluminium. These sculptures are life-size and create an uncanny experience whereby Alex's painted figures inhabit our space. While he painted flowers and landscapes in the 1960s, he became particularly devoted to portraiture and figures at that time, often painting the dynamic milieu around him in New York in that period, including poets like John Ashbery, Frank O'Hara and James Schuyler, whose approach to language and direct channeling of human experience were critical to Alex's own work, as well as the dance critic and poet Edward Denby and his partner, the filmmaker Rudy Burkhart, and numerous artists and curators in the New York scene. He began to expand the scale of his painting to match that of the movie screen and billboard advertising, as in The Red Smile of 1963, which features a portrait of Ada dynamically cropped to intensify her features and set against a vivid red background, which also amplifies the deep blue of Ada's Alice band. At the same time, he increasingly portrayed groups of people and a high-spirited social world, including in the two much-celebrated multi-figure compositions from 1965, The Cocktail Party and Lawn Party. Though his works of this period shared pop art's immediacy, colour and flirtation with mass media, Alex's work was distinct from that movement in always insisting on the painterly touch rather than the impersonal and mechanical means of making of Andy Warhol, for instance. Partly, this was because of the strides he was making in his style, painting quickly wet into wet, which he discusses more in our conversation. He also began using the Renaissance technique of cartoons, in which he would make large drawings and attach them to the blank canvas before pouncing holes in the paper paper through which he would push pigment to create the drawing to scale on the canvas. Through the 1970s and into the 1980s, his portraits and figure paintings gained much acclaim and a retrospective at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York in 1986. But Alex did not rest on his laurels and confessed after the Whitney show that he was intent on moving to a place in art that was unstable and terrifying, as he put it. That mostly consisted of a new and bold approach to city and landscapes on often hugely enveloping canvases that he called environmental. They include the dazzling painting Lake Light of 1992, for instance, reflecting sun on water, the Black Brook series of the 1980s and 1990s, which captures glimpses of light on dark water, and the brooding, noirish 1990s paintings of office buildings by night. His engagement with landscape has been unrelenting ever since, and he continues to push these canvases into ever more abstract territory today, including in new series of paintings of water and grassy meadows for an exhibition at the Cini Foundation in Venice for the 2024 Biennale. He has also responded poetically, even emotionally, to the experience of seeing light through trees. Now, in some of the things I paint, he has said, I leave out the thing and just paint the sensation. But he equally never ceases to evolve his approach to the people around him, with recent works increasingly employing fragmented views of faces and figures brought into juxtapositions full of dynamic movement. He's described the genesis of his work in what he calls an initial blast, which he needs to record in his painted sketches. And it's this with which I began our conversation. What happened in that blast?
You have an idea of what art should be. And when something connects with that, you go for it. Just like that, it's a flash and you're on.
And you've talked about the importance of the optical element of your work.
Well, when I was in art school, I got a scholarship to Skowhegan, which was a provincial art school. And they were doing like realistic painting. So I got involved with the idea of what is realistic. And it was like Pandora's box. Because what you said, what's realistic? Well, Rembrandt isn't realistic anymore. And you realize that realism is something that changes every 20 years. It's subject to fashion. And so that put me on the road. That seemed like an interesting way to go, to try to make a new realistic painting.
Yeah.
And so the forms I took, I wanted to have the energy of Pollock, or de Kooning, or Klein. So that dictated the form, or what I wanted in the form. I wanted the painting to come off the wall with a lot of energy.
Yeah, and tell me about that optical quality that you were seeking, with the difference.
I know when I was in art school, taking art history, the instructor put up a Donatello and said it was realistic, and I screamed. It was a dark place, and a couple of hundred people there, and I screamed, it isn't realistic. And the teacher agreed with me. And what it was is Donatello's lifelike. So then from realism, it moved to the idea of the sensation of seeing something rather than depicting the object faithfully or the scene faithfully. And that determined my path, and that was very early when I started that. And you try things, and they work out for a while, and they're not that interesting, and you move on.
And you've always said that moving on was absolutely crucial, and even if it was terrifying to move on, it was important to do it.
Oh, yeah, you have no idea where you are. Like, I did a painting yesterday, and well, I had no idea it was any good at all. That, you know, and I can tell my assistants prepare it. I asked him, he said it was pretty good, and I can usually screen what he's saying, you know. And so I said, well, I guess it's okay. I knew that.
Right.
from the tone of his voice, the painting was okay. And then later on, some people came in and they liked it, so I guess it's okay. I have to get used to it. And in a week or two, I'll be able to know exactly what I feel about it.
I was going to say, do you leave your works for a certain amount of time to really know?
Well, some paintings you know and others you don't know. And if you're in an area that you've been working in, you pretty much can tell it if you do a good painting. But if you're in a real experimental area, you have no way of knowing what you're doing. It's an unnerving situation. And I think most painters get out of it by just repeating themselves.
But this key thing about your work, it seems to me, is that you're always testing it. So you've made Ada in a white dress in 58. And by 59, you're doing Ada. So you're consistently pushing.
Yeah, I'm always pushing. I've been that way to stay alive or die, pretty much.
You mentioned de Kooning and Pollock, and you talked about how you wanted your work to have a muscularity that theirs had,
right,
but be figurative but muscular. Tell us more about that.
Real muscular. And I chose a sort of inane subject matter, and people thought of them. There was sissy stuff, like little flowers and pretty girls. But I held down that Guggenheim, and none of those machos could hold it down, the whole place.
Yeah. It seems to me that there was a tremendous outpouring of, well, critical attention on the one hand, but also it was clear that artists right across New York and everybody that was visiting were overwhelmed by that experience at the Guggenheim, actually.
Yeah. People just didn't realize how muscular the paintings are.
Right.
And how varied. You have an idea of someone and it's sort of close to a particular time and place.
I wanted to ask about your process, because you mentioned about Skowhegan and how you were encouraged then to go out into the landscape to draw, and how that was a kind of liberating aspect for you. But you also built on it not to locate it within a kind of tradition, but to find a modern kind of painting that could emerge from that plein air kind of situation.
The plein air thing got me to paint from my unconscious. And it was actually, it was not that different from the surrealist painting of Masson and Pollock when I was painting landscapes, except they were painting inside and I was painting outside. And you're trying to clean yourself going outside of all the personal stuff.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like going towards something. It finally, when I ran into Demby, he had de Koonings all over his loft because de Kooning lived next door and was broken. He'd help him out. De Kooning gave him paintings. And he believed in the classicism of de Kooning. So on one hand, I went from more subjective painting to trying to paint something bigger than personal. Best example of that would be Giotto. You know, it's big and personal, but he can give you personal feelings in it, you know? And that's like in the form, I would say, he'd be number one.
That's really interesting, because you've also talked about how unbelievably precise he was in terms of the form, while still having that incredible interiority that you're talking about. The interior life of Mary is evident in the depiction of the Virgin, if you like.
I went to a really dumb high school. I think it was, you know, real low rent. And I think if you stayed in your chair, you'd get an 80. And there was a cop's car out there to bust it up. But a friend of mine, who's also an artist, wanted to go there because you could do art half a day. And you couldn't do that in the regular high school. And so I liked the antique statues that they drew from the antique. And they could do whatever you wanted there. So I started drawing from the antique. And after a couple of years, I could do one pretty good. And that's the basis of the stability of my painting. It gives a good drawing, gives your painting substance. And, it's what I wanted. So from cast drawing to Cézanne was really easy. His stuff has so much substance.
And, of course, drawing sort of underpins your work today.
Yeah, the antique drawing from the cast is of no value in making art, except what you, it broadens your base. You have to add other things. The antique drawing would take a week to make one drawing, 3 hours every afternoon. And finally, I got to make a good one. And when I started painting, I was in the Navy and I got out. I was supposed to get a scholarship to Pratt or something. I went there and they were all full. And someone said, there's a school in New York that's pretty good, Cooper Union. It's free. And I had the bill, so I went. I had 3 days. I went and took the test, and I got in. I couldn't believe it, because I was taking. I remember there was a table, seven or eight guys, and they were all doing Picasso sculpture, and I didn't. I ain't got the nerve. I ain't got the nerve to try it. I had with a guy with a duck's ass haircut, and twisted in the end. And I never saw any of those guys again.
And also, I got a high mark in it, too. It was like 1,800 people took the test, 90 got in, and I was in the top 10, I guess, with the aptitude. So I said, well, I got a good aptitude for art tests, you know. But I didn't know what was going on. Cooper Union was one of the few really modern art schools in the United States. It was really provincial, with American painting, and pretty crummy, too. And there weren't real good paintings in the Metropolitan Museum, well, a handful, maybe, and the rest were just really bad examples from good artists. And so they'd say something in the books, and you look at the painting and say, I don't get it. And years later, you see a first-class exam, and you say, now I get it. And I think the time frame with a lot of the modern stuff was in the immediate present and no baggage. And that didn't seem logical to me. And it was like anything I experience is okay. From like a movie like Pillow Talk, I think it's fantastic, to Rembrandt, where you can't take a lot of the subject matter seriously, but you sure love the technique.
Yeah.
And the paintings, yeah.
So you had that conviction to make work, as you said, about now. You wanted to make work about the present, but which had a connection to the history.
Well, the present is a connection of you and your life and everything else. I felt I didn't feel the modern. I compete with the complete modernist thing, and I think they have more access to fashion than I do in art, you know, because they don't carry anything but the latest thing. But they age quicker than I do. Most paintings, they get worse every year.
And the trick is to try to create a work which retains a certain timelessness.
Or gets better every year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You paint wet in wet. We were talking about risks earlier on. You're walking a tightrope working wet in wet, right?
Yeah, this is like fancy painting. I started out trying to make a new surface, and I used gesso and thin paint, derived partially from the technique of Matisse. Mm-hmm. They aged very poorly, the Matisses and the Picassos. They used a lot of terp to keep the paint. Their idea of making something new was to make another surface, and the surface was flat and porous. And so after 10 years, I decided to close the surface down, and then I went to a fatter ground and fatter paint, and it's still with the same idea of freshness in painting. But I painted direct from the beginning. I wanted the fresh painting. And it's like, if it doesn't work out, throw it out and do another one. That was the idea, more or less. Anyhow, the wet and wet technique is a way of making a painting faster, you know, and varied, and a maximum skill. Because you put a color on the whole canvas and you paint into it. And when you make a mark, you might have four or five tones on each stroke instead of one. So you get out of that kind of rigid, flat painting, and it gets trickier and trickier.
I can imagine. But it means that you don't noodle, right, as you put it?
No noodling.
Yeah.
It's a trade-off. If you noodle a little, it gets more refined. And if you don't, it gets fresher.
Right.
You know, I don't fool around. It's pretty much arm painting, not finger painting, which was noodling. De Kooning, in a sense, refines too much. He's a great painter. But he has a tendency to just refine. It's a form of noodling on a very high level.
Right. So in a way, as you're pushing that wet and wet process to the absolute limits, you're at risk of losing the painting, and then you can't get it back, right?
Absolutely. Well, you wipe it down and start all over, you know.
Let's move on to the questions that we ask all our guests. Who was the first artist whose work you loved?
Cézanne. I was in high school and someone brought a book in with it, and I said, wow, I really liked it. I liked it for the emotional structure. People wrote things about how intellectual he was and all that, but they really appealed to me because a real person painted it, and it had a lot of emotional power.
Yeah. I think that's what Matisse loved about Cézanne too, you know. He had a Cézanne in his home, yeah, and he and his family would sit around it like it was a television or something, you know.
Cézanne's almost a continuum of Michelangelo. If you put a line on the bumps, they're like big curves like Cézanne used. Mm. And Matisse draws the same way. They draw from the outside in, you know.
Yeah.
That was a great way to get started. But when I started to paint outdoors, I was wanting to go out. You were sick and tired of going in. Then I looked at Bonnard. Bonnard spreads like Pollock. It was Pollock and Bonnard became the people who were doing what I wanted to do.
I was really struck by the fact that you said about Bonnard that he gave you a way around Picasso and Matisse, who, of course, were the dominant people.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us what you meant by that.
Well, Picasso and Matisse work on volumes in, and Bonnard works on light out. Bonnard's light is, the structure is similar to a lot of Pollock's. They just move out. To work with a specific information, moving out seems a real challenge.
Mm.
And that's what I sort of did.
Is it too easy an association for me to make to say that that wonderful painting you did recently of a yellow tree relates to Bonnard and that amazing mimosa painting, that the incredible vibrant yellow of Bonnard's mimosa tree that he created?
Oh, thank you.
Well, I mean, it fills the canvas. And it seemed to me that you talk about how in recent paintings you sometimes leave the thing out and just paint the sensation. But again, I think Bonnard was painting sensation as much as he was painting trees, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bonnard was going where he wanted to go. And it was an extension of Impressionism of Monet. Monet worked out, but in a 19th century manner compared to Bonnard.
Mm.
And Bonnard was intimate. And he has one big painting in the Phillips Gallery in Washington, D.C. that's really fantastic. But most of it's small. And I wanted to be in the American painting, which is large. A different way of going.
Tell us about Degas. We're on to sort of historical artists. There was that whole body of work called Hommage to Degas, where you worked directly from the sculptures but made paintings. So tell me about that.
No, I made sculpture, flat sculpture, mm-hmm, from Degas. Degas, for my money, is the best sculptor of the 19th century. They have all of his bronzes in the Metropolitan Museum, and they have them in vitrines and stuff packed against the wall. I thought it was disgusting. I think his sculpture is more amazing than anything of his, but he did fantastic drawings. You can spend minutes looking at the way he does the shoulder and the stuff on the shoulder and how he makes a tutu with someone under it with nothing. And his monotypes are incredible. You know,
yeah.
I have three of them.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, well, no, I saw the show. I couldn't believe it. They were so great, those monos. And that, he was drawing from, like, the classic, from the outside. You know, when we started doing the monotypes, he took away the outside and just made the form from the inside of the volume. You know that there's no linear construction on that stuff. That's where he's come from. So it was quite a bit of courage to move the way he did.
Yeah.
And he experimented on the monotypes. That's what they are especially. How do you get that much form, solid form, with no confinement? It's quite amazing. And if you look at the bronzes, you'll find one of them, they have tremendous distortions for the gesture. If you look at them, one has a foot is about 1 foot shorter than the other foot, and things like that happen all the time in them.
You really feel them being made, don't you? You feel his touch in those sculptures so tremendously. There's the feeling of him feeling through the figure and drawing with the sculpture and so on.
Now, the painting, he was interested in the figures, and in the end, the paintings got bigger, but they're mostly like the big pastels. He's interested in the figure, and he isn't interested in anything past the edge of the figure.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in a sense, like Sargent.
The way he cropped figures, obviously partly informed by photography.
Yeah.
Did that help you with the way that you would go on to crop?
Think of it, it must have, but my idea of crops came from movies, and movies and advertising were a real big influence to me. But they made things that look new, and I want my paintings to look new.
While we're on historical artists, I wanted to talk to you about the Baroque, and particularly Rubens, because I know that you were hugely impressed when you saw Rubens in the Louvre.
I didn't get to Paris until I was 35, and Rubens was put down heavily in the period in the 40s. And when I looked at the Rubens, I said, you can't think of right and wrong. They have so much energy. And then when I saw the Veronese, an oval Veronese, I said, wow, that is more muscular than anything in New York. You know?
Yeah.
And that became the thing. It was like Pollock was all over, but the Baroque was really like expanding energy. I did sets and stuff with Paul Taylor, the dancer.
Mm.
And he was very sharp on styling. And he did a piece to Bach, which was revolutionary, actually, for high avant-garde. And I always thought that Bach was, people used to present him to me as, it's all in planes, like cubism, you know? And when I watched the dance, it was Baroque, and it was expanding energy, the idea of expanding energy. And that seemed like a great thing to go for. The reductive thing was like a single figure on a flat background in the height of the abstract expressionist.
Yeah, at the same sort of time that you did Ada in the white dress. So it's that great moment.
Yeah, the Ada in the white dress, that's right.
Yeah.
But when I did that piece with Paul, then the idea of the Baroque came to me.
And then I also wanted to ask you about Japanese prints, and particularly Utamaro, who I know is of tremendous importance to you.
Yeah, this guy said he has a girlfriend in Bayside. Would we like to go with him to see her? So we went, and it was very boring. And she says, well, my husband sends me these prints from Japan. Would you like to look at them? She went under the couch, pulled out this box of prints, and they were Utamaro's. And they knocked my head off. They just seemed like what I wanted to do. And I used it, like when I have six women, he did six women, so I have six women.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it comes straight from him, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think he's really a sensational artist.
That's amazing. So the painting you're talking about is where there are six versions of Ada in different poses.
It all comes from Utamaro.
Right.
Yeah.
And in that painting, of course, you have the poet James Schuyler looking down over the six versions of Ada.
It was on the wall. You just paint what's in front of you. And if it doesn't work out, take it out. You know, but don't avoid it. When I was a kid, there was this other artist who took me to this horrible high school. And he said, let's go on a bike and find something to paint. So we ride 20 miles, we find a motif that he liked, and we both painted watercolors. And we bring him home and show him to my father. And he looks at Dix and he says, you're going to be a great commercial artist. And Dick became a great commercial artist. And he looked at mine, and it was awful. He said, you're going to have to be a fine artist. And then he said, why don't you paint your own backyard? And I couldn't see the backyard for anything. And he said, and don't paint the details. Paint the whole thing. Paint the impression of what you're seeing. I always resented the fact that my father could not answer my question. He would answer what I was thinking. So I thought he was, in a sense, smarter than me. And I resented it.
A Brush With is sponsored by Bloomberg Connects, the arts and culture app. The free app offers access to close to 400 cultural organisations through a single download, with new guides being added regularly. Recent additions to the app include the Maison Européenne de la Photographie in Paris and the Wexner Centre for the Arts in Columbus, Ohio. The Wexner Centre is among the many guides to leading US art museums and galleries on Bloomberg Connects, and many of them have shown and collected the works of Alex Katz. They include the McNay Art Museum in San Antonio, which was the first dedicated modern art museum in the state of Texas. Download the guide to the McNay and you can explore its permanent collection, which now includes medieval and Renaissance art alongside modern and contemporary highlights. You can also look in depth at the museum's exhibitions, including A Particular Beauty, 19th century French art at the McNay. The guide features audio content on works in the show, including pieces by Bert Morisot and Edouard Manet. To explore digital guides to all the partnering institutions, download the app today. It's available from the App Store and Google Play, and you can keep up to date by following Bloomberg Connects on Facebook, X formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram. Let's talk about contemporary art. Which contemporary artists do you most admire?
Well, right now, there's a resurgence of a painter called Martha Diamond. And Martha Diamond was a lady who emerged in the 70s with the Know-Nothing painters. There were a bunch of them, mostly women. And she comes into the art world in the 60s. And it has the quality it has is total self-indulgence, you know?
Yeah.
Lots of parties and lots of dope. Lots of tennis. There was an interview with her. She said she worked at the Museum of Modern Art. She said, yes, some poet would bring dope to me. It was heaven. It was great. And she was in a fog, and the career went from being fashionable for, as it goes, it's usually 3 years or 4 years, and then the artist disappears, more or less. And she disappeared, and it didn't go anywhere. And all of a sudden, there's a revival. And David Sally put a picture of hers next to a de Kooning, and it ate up the de Kooning.
Wow.
So despite the self-indulgent lifestyle, the painting was dead serious and very muscular. They about kill anything you put next to them.
I know the paintings of buildings. I've only seen a little of her work, but yeah, these enormous buildings, which are kind of, yeah.
That's right. Enormous buildings that she paints with her left hand. So they're very kind of physical. That's the idea. I think the Rudy Shingle show on now is the best show in town. I think he's a great designer. He belongs to the conceptual art, more or less. It's extremely proficient, and it takes the cake on what's in town.
What do you have pinned to the studio wall?
Well, I'm finishing up a lot of landscapes, and they'll be shown in the Museum of Modern Art this summer. And I'm going to start on a series of landscapes that are really thin ice. They're, what would you say, after image.
Ah.
I have nothing to lose, and I'm going to try it. And after image is, you're in a green, you're outside in the summer, and you go into a room, and there's a red flash. It's a rare experience that we've all had.
Yeah.
And that's Matisse's Red Room.
Exactly. I was going to say, supposedly that is why Matisse painted the studio red, because of having been out in the garden.
Of course, he was outdoors in the green. So I'm starting on, I did the first one, and unfortunately, it was a success. Which means I have to go into this thin ice. I see, in my mind, I can see a red room, and that's where I am.
And do you have works by other artists on the studio wall, or do you just have your own things?
I have a Bonnard and a Picabia in the house. They're both kind of terrific paintings. And in the bedroom, I have lots of drawings and stuff of other artists. I like Matisse prints.
Yeah.
The ones that are just black and white.
Oh, my God. They're amazing. Yeah.
I think they're terrific. And he did some in the 20s. I have a couple of those. And all sorts of odd stuff. Oh, I have a de Kooning drawing.
Wow.
I think he's terrific.
Yeah.
And I have an early Joel Shapiro that's really great.
Uh-huh.
Sculpture, wall sculpture, and a floor sculpture, actually. Oh, that English lady, Chantal.
Oh, yeah, Chantal Joffe.
Yeah, I have a painting of hers that's real good.
Oh, right, that's fantastic. I'm sure she'd be thrilled to hear that.
Yeah.
She's a great painter.
She's a terrific artist, yeah, terrific painter.
Which museum or gallery do you visit most frequently?
Well, at this point, I'm 96 going on 97. And I used to go to see galleries, very interesting. I'd like to see young people's work. In fact, I made a foundation to buy young people's work and give it to museums. The money's no good to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd go to Soho and Lower East Side. Now, this year, I've decided I don't want to take stuff in so much, and I want to just push it out. So I don't go to openings, and I don't go to galleries much.
Do you ever have the need to sort of go to the Met and see something or go to MoMA and see something?
Not too much. I usually go to the Met. They have the new installation. I went to see it. And the installation was a failure because of the frames.
Uh-huh.
They put the dark walls and the frames, and the frames were too bright. They made them accurate, and they were too bright. They had the Frick was shown at the Old Whitney.
Yeah.
And that was gorgeous.
Yeah, it looked amazing.
Perfect frames and perfect background, and you could see the Fragonard so clearly. He's a first-class painter, actually.
Mm, agreed.
And it looked like wallpaper in the old Frick, and you could see it there. Our museums don't indicate the energy of our country at all. We started behind in provincial, and we haven't caught up, particularly with young painters. There's so many of them coming into the city. And I don't think the museum helped them that much. Because when you're in art school, it's heaven. 3 years out of art school, it's great. And then all of a sudden, you're alone and you're going nowheres and you're an adult. And it's kind of really rough.
I'm sure.
And you get some outside encouragement. It means a great deal. And that was the purpose of it.
Which cultural experience changed the way you see the world?
I think everything does. I think there's a big cultural wave that came through New York, and it was in poetry. So you had these non-linear poets like Frank O'Hara and Jimmy Schuyler. Mm. And you had the jazz musicians who were non-linear and upstyle like Stan Getz and Prez and Charlie Parker. And they were all related to Jackson Pollock, who's non-linear and de Kooning. And it's a big cultural wave. And what you try to do is get some energy, get into the cultural wave. And I think the story of like dealers control the culture, that's not true. No one controls the culture. It's just a wave. And it starts from the energy of the country, you know?
Yeah.
The energy of the times. The war was over and they were striking out in new directions. Because what's happened, something's good and then it gets boring. And it's boring, you just got to move out of it. By 1954, if you were dripping, you were way behind. It was gone. And so there were a lot of people starting with the hard edge, started with my collages.
You spoke about those as the first time that you knew you were making art.
Yeah, I knew I was making art because my idea was it wasn't a career. It was art. When you got out of school, I figured like this, I didn't have a lot of talent. There were 1,800 people took the test and the 3 years. I was the best painter by far. And I figured if I come that far in 3 years, I could do it. Make art in 20. At 20 years on the planet, I said I'd make some art and give it my best shot. And when I stopped making the classes, well, I'm making art. And the big decision was turn the collages into a product, make them larger. The collage made large would be a successful product, but the idea of portraiture is more interesting. So I stopped the collages and started on portraiture. And it ended up being more interesting, but less negotiable.
Yeah, it was almost like a political gesture to do that in the art world at that time.
Yeah. When I went that way, people wouldn't speak to me, really.
How amazing.
And other people hated me. It was the stuffiness of the abstract expressions. It was so pompous. It didn't relate to the life I was living. I liked dancing and basketball. I played varsity basketball in Cooper Union.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine any expressionist playing varsity basketball. Or dancing. We used to go dancing at the Palladium, and there weren't any artists there, just the people we knew. That was like the cultural life.
And the poets liked dancing.
Now, the poets all went dancing by themselves. But there was a reaction to the pompousness, and the pop art was it. Hmm. And my paintings were getting these terrific amount of attention at starting in 1949 with the flat backgrounds and then the double layers and all that. And the critics kept saying something about they're like comic strips. And then Fairfield Porter says, I have this painter, Roy Lichtenstein, who's doing something like what you're doing. Can I bring him to your studio? And I said, sure. So he came to the studio and I met the guy and he was trying to get into Leo Castelli. And Jap and Bob didn't like him at all, the paintings. And Ivan Karp did. And so I went down and saw him and I said, Alex, it's over. you can join and follow him or go your own way. And I said, I got to go my own way. And Andy Warhol came by and he took the single figure on a flat background and the double later and made Elvis out of it. And when I started doing the big head portraits, he was at the party with Alida Hornix, and he stopped in front of the picture. I said, shit, he's going to do it again. And he did. He started the whole portrait square, and my Alida Hornix thing was blood to paint it, you know? Mm. And it's kind of a stiff painting. It's in the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah.
And he had great success. And anyway, that was the pop art movement.
Go back to the poets. It seems like an amazing community that you were in of exchange between you and the poets, between James Schuyler.
Well, they formed a natural audience for me. And they actually, just about all of them bought work of mine who had any kind of money at all. Mm. The poets and people that connected with, I didn't sell anything to people from the outer world until, I don't know, 15 years out of art school. The poetry world was fantastic. Frank O'Hara became my hero. He's romantic, which I'm not, and verbose, which I'm not, but the spirit of personal extension, it's like Ruff compared to Schuyler or Ashbery, or even Kenneth Coke, but it has an emotional extension that I really admired.
Talking about music, do you have music playing in the studio while you work?
Generally put music on to cut out the outside sounds.
Yeah.
The last couple of years, I don't even pick the records. My son picks them.
But you talked about how important jazz was to you. Do you ever put on jazz to create a kind of mood, or do you ever put music on?
No. It's just to keep outside sounds away from me.
Right. What other media influence your work? This would be a good moment to talk about film. The point you mentioned earlier, that it was seeing Westerns and so on that prompted you to build the scale of your pictures up.
Yeah, in the 50s, I was carving frames 3 days a week, and that could support me. And when I finished carving at the end of the day, my arms are tired, and I'd go into the nearest movie house. I didn't even look at the marquee. I just walk in and buy it. And they were showing a lot of Westerns. And they're breaking up the rectangle like I've never seen in any painting. Like a head, a big head on one side of the film, a big head, and then a lot of landscape. And so I started experimenting with these big things. I wanted to get that painting in the room as fast as a Klein. And the big head was my vehicle. And by 1952 or 3, I was doing it.
And I think particularly of that great painting called The Red Smile. The one of Ada with...
Yeah, I did that early. And Frank O'Hara was a curator at the Modern. He's trying to get it in there, and Bob wouldn't go. And so it ended up in the Whitney.
Right.
Years later.
You've talked about those sort of flat backgrounds and the atmosphere you want to create with them. What do you mean by the atmosphere?
Well, it's not flat. If it's enough of color, it's something that creates atmosphere. And the first one, it was the portrait of Lucy and Irving Sandler. Mm. It's on a white ground. Mm. I spent more time on the background than on the figures.
Really? Yeah.
Trying to get the picture of the white as a place the figures could exist. And I got that from the collages. You have a piece of paper, you put something in, the background gets activated. And you think of it as real atmosphere in a real place. And that comes from the abstract paintings I was looking at.
Is there a particular discipline in your daily working life that you see as an essential ritual?
Yeah, I wake up at 7:30. I do exercise and walk around the block. Spend almost an hour eating breakfast in the newspapers to consider debauchery. But I like the way it works on my mind.
Can you feel yourself thinking of paintings while you're doing it, or is it a separate act?
There's an area when you're sleeping where you're not awake and not really asleep.
Yeah.
You do a lot of thinking, and I usually spend that time thinking of what brush and what the layer of the paint, you know, and sometimes I paint paintings. Like this morning, last night, I was doing the end of these landscapes. I'm trying to make the paintings expand enough on a small scale so I don't have to paint a big painting of a landscape. Mm-hmm. That's the idea. So I'm near the end of it. I have about three more paintings to do, and I have the picture in my sleep is a figure, little figures inside of the big painting. And I was surprised this morning where there weren't any. Because I had it all worked out how I was going to paint them.
That's fantastic. You also swim in Maine, is that right? Every morning when you're in Maine, you swim in the morning.
Yeah, I'm a complete jock all the way through. And the body is broken down, so I can't do as much as I did. And COVID came and stopped things. But I used to run, swim, and bike in the summer. I had a nasty fall on a bike. The next day, my son took the bikes away. It was a great idea. And the swimming, I used to swim in NYU. And they tore down this building and started building another one. So that took care of the swimming in the winter. I was swimming 3 days. Mm. Basketball ended when I was 55 or something. Mm. And running really went down. But I do an hour of exercise every morning.
That's amazing. If you could live with just one work of art, what would it be?
Thutmose is the sculptor's name, who did Nefertiti. And he's the best for me. Absolutely the best artist ever. I like Giotto a lot too. But if you go to museums, you find his drawings are like incisions on limestone. And he models as good as Raphael. His line drives as good as Urumaro or Matisse. Great edge in line. Mm. And his styling is as good as James or Balenciaga. His styling is fantastic. And his examples are in different places. And I usually run there to see the sketches. They have some nice ones in the Met, actually, that people don't know about.
And lastly, what is art for?
Oh, well, it's multiple. Art is to represent the culture of the country. I think that's its number one purpose to most people. And that's what it does. No matter how bohemian the artist is, the work should represent the energy of the culture. It's Jackson Pollock who represented the energy of the post-war America better than anyone, better than any movie or anything else. It was really, that's where we are and that's who we are. That's a big part of it. For the artist, it's a proof that he existed.
Alex, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Alex Katz, Claire, Grass and Water is at the Fondazione Giorgio Chini in Venice from the 17th of April to the 29th of September. Alex Katz, Wedding Dresses is at the Portland Museum of Art in Portland, Maine in the US until the 2nd of June. And Alex Katz, Collaborations with Poets is at the Butler Institute of American Art in Youngstown, Ohio from the 15th of September to the 15th of November. And that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to A Brush With wherever you're listening and do give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Do also subscribe to our sister podcast, The Week in Art, a deep dive into the latest big art world stories, the top shows and the key issues every week. And please subscribe to the art newspaper at theartnewspaper.com. We're on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Tan Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. Production, editing and sound design on A Brush With are by David Clack and the producer is Lewis Jebb. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway. Big thank you to Alex Katz. See you next week. Bye for now. A Brush With is sponsored by Bloomberg Connects. Download Bloomberg Connects today and discover cultural institutions on demand.